From La Trobe to Grantham, Lebanon to Connellsville, this is the Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, lawmakers were unable to agree on moving the 2024 Pennsylvania presidential primary election to an earlier date, so the voting will take place as scheduled in late April. David Taylor is here to host a Capitol Watch discussion on why the effort collapsed. And Governor Josh Shapiro entered office with a reputation for getting things done. But 10 months into his term, several critical missteps have sullied that reputation. I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capitol Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Democrats are lining up to challenge incumbent Republicans in next year's elections for statewide constitutional or row offices. Philadelphia City Controller Alan Butkovitz is set to announce his candidacy for state treasurer. He joins State Representative Ryan Bizarro of Erie and Allegheny County Democrat Aaron McClellan in wanting to challenge incumbent state treasurer Stacey Garrity. Meanwhile, State Representative Mark Rossi of Berks County has announced his candidacy for Auditor General. Rossi seeks to challenge incumbent Auditor General Timothy DeFore. Rossi made news earlier this year when he briefly served as Speaker of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, pending two special elections that determined majority control of the chamber. Pennsylvania voters will also be electing a new state attorney general next year. What is shaping up as a marquee national battle between incumbent U.S. Senator Robert P. Casey Jr. and likely Republican nominee Dave McCormick for a seat in the U.S. Senate will also highlight next year's ballot. In the meantime, Pennsylvania voters will be electing a state Supreme Court justice, along with a Commonwealth Court judge and two Superior Court judges, in next month's general election. The campaign trail proved hazardous for Republican Superior Court candidate Maria Batista, who was hospitalized this past week after being struck by a car while putting up campaign signs. Batista suffered a broken collarbone but is expected back on the campaign trail in a few days. School board elections are also on the ballot this year, and the battle over parental rights is taking center stage in many of those races. Meanwhile, in Harrisburg, the state Senate this past week approved a bill sponsored by Senator Doug Mastriano that would improve access for parents to learn what their children are being taught in schools. Mastriano's bill would require schools to post on a publicly accessible website an internet link for every textbook and course syllabus. The measure now goes to the state house for concurrence. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The goal was to move the 2024 Pennsylvania primary to an earlier date to give our state a bigger voice in the presidential nominating process and move the voting away from the Jewish holiday of Passover. But dysfunction in the state house doomed the effort. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation for a Capitol Watch roundtable discussion. David.
And welcome once again to Capitol Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, your Capitol Watch All-Stars from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, President and CEO, Rebecca Euler. Rebecca, thanks for being on the show.
Great to be here today, David. Thank you.
And my pal, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, great to see you.
Same. Great to see you, David.
Well, thanks to all the listeners for tuning in, and we'll give you the straight scoop as we see it from Sin City, Harrisburg, PA. So I guess the first item of business is that there was sort of an issue outstanding that finally got rectified just because nothing could be done, that there was an interest in moving the 2024 primary election in Pennsylvania to accelerate it in time to put us in the mix to be one of the deciding states for the presidential primary. That now is not going to come to pass.
Yeah, and that legislation was not necessarily in any way partisan. It was just an effort to put Pennsylvania in a more strategic spot in the presidential primary system so that the state of Pennsylvania would essentially have more clout in choosing who ultimately would be the presidential nominees running for office in the next presidential election cycle. So it was a widely supported, relatively non-controversial idea of moving up what is a very late primary date currently under Pennsylvania law to a date where Pennsylvania would be more involved in determining that early trends that usually dictate who ultimately does very well in a primary and who doesn't. Unfortunately, our legislature it's a divided legislature, a Republican-controlled Senate and a Democratic-controlled House. The Democratic-controlled House in particular has a very, very narrow majority. They're not able to do much because of their very narrow majority. And ultimately, a bill was sent over to them from the Senate. It was a fairly straightforward bill, but the Democrats chose to first delay it for quite some time and then adorn it with all sorts of things that most Republicans wouldn't have wanted. And ultimately, we learned that they were going to compromise on simply moving the election up 1 week. And no one wanted that. That wasn't worth all the trouble.
Right.
It interfered with some religious holidays of various faiths. And in fact, the county officials who administer elections said, first of all, there's not enough time now left because you guys dawdled for so long.
Yes.
We can't do it well. And it would be a difficult for a 1 week improvement. It's simply not worth
it. Right, right. And of course, you know, that all of these things, and Rebecca, you can guide us through this, that you, in your previous, one of your previous incarnations, that you were at Pennsylvania's Department of State that oversees elections, that there are different processes that it's like a daisy chain, that one abuts the other. And so candidates have to circulate petitions to get enough signatures to qualify for the ballot, so on and so forth.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And a lot of people, they come to the polls on election day or cast their vote through the mail, and they think that election is once a year or, you know, 1 month a year or whatever. But county election offices work all year long. There is quite a lot of administrative work that needs to go into running our elections in a smooth, you know, and secure way. And even just squeezing sort of some of those timelines and deadlines in between the two big elections we have every year now takes a lot of effort. I mean, obviously there's registering voters, there's training poll workers, there's programming the voting machines, prepping all the materials, the poll books and everything that need to go out into the polling places. That takes a lot of effort. And some of the more recent changes to election procedures, of course, sort of shorten the timelines that everyone has in that, you know, there are now a lot more mail votes cast than used to be the case. So more, you know, more mail ballots are printed, more mail ballots are sent out and tracked. And so all of these things have to be administered in between those sort of deadlines. There are also 9,000 polling places in the state, and a lot of those polling places are in schools and other businesses where, you know, those school calendars were made up, you know, last year. It's difficult right now to get a school district to change their calendar or arrange, you know, to have their students out of school that day if they normally do that on election days. The other interesting thing I found out, I didn't know this, that Rhode Island, Delaware, and Maryland are also scheduled for the same day as our primary election day in Pennsylvania, and they all moved their primaries to earlier in the year.
Huh.
So we will be the only primary election on that day this year.
Goodness. The legislature has been in session after having been away for quite some time. It still seems as though like not a whole lot is happening right now.
And we're still seeing the effects, first of all, of the very narrow Democratic majority in the House. They have to be the Democratic side has to be completely in agreement on virtually every bill that they pass because they have one vote majority to pass it.
Right.
So that right out of the gate eliminates much legislation from even being considered in the House. The leaders are afraid to run it because they're afraid they won't get
lose control.
Their 102, and then the Republicans will de facto have control. So we've seen that sluggish aspect of the House really dragging things down across the board for the Senate as well, not by the Senate's fault, but just because the House is more or less in a state of quasi-paralysis. We're now 4 months, just about 4 months from the June 30th budget deadline, and a huge chunk of the budget is not done. Over $1 billion of critical apportionments to different entities such as public schools included that, some of the poorest public schools. There's level up funding in there for them. there are a number of other important expenditures that need to be made, and there's no fiscal code, even though many of these items were included in the list of appropriations, the bill that passed the general appropriations bill. Yeah. They can't be implemented without a fiscal code bill that tells all the details of where it goes and where it comes from. And so that's not getting done. And part of that is the Lifeline Scholarship Program. Part of it is the EITC, OSTC tax credits that are typically raised. They're part of the budget, and they if there are any increase, that goes into effect the next year. So there's all these important things sitting there open. And again, because of this deadlock, and in particular in this case, it seems the intransigent Democratic-controlled House unwilling to compromise or negotiate and really not being serious about the kinds of bills they're passing.
Yeah.
They passed some fiscal code bills that were just layered up with goodies that the Democrats wanted for themselves. They knew the Republicans weren't going to be able to vote for. Sent those over to the Republicans and said, hey, why don't you pass that?
Yeah.
And the Republicans are taking a pass on passing that.
Correct.
And rightfully so. But we need to get kind of adults in the room and put some pressure on the House Democrats to let some bills run.
Well, and this actually goes back to, you know, Governor Shapiro, the campaign that he ran last year, the tone that he struck in his budget address back in March, saying that in an era of divided government that we're going to have to play the game between the 40-yard lines and that these sort of more extreme things are going to be out of bounds.
The corporate net income tax reductions that the Governor Shapiro campaigned on, that he would try to get those sped up, the reduction, the rate of reducing Pennsylvania's corporate net income tax to make us more competitive with other states. And instead of being able to do that, the Democrat-controlled House passed a bill with, yes, they included the CNI. They passed a tax code bill. They included the CNI reduction. But then they included your favorite phrase,
mandatory unitary combined reporting.
Which is a deal killer.
It's a poison pill. Yes,
we're on such harmony. It's amazing.
Yes, sir. and it's infuriating because the positive things that were included, that taking our 8.99% corporate income tax, and currently we're on a glide path to the year 2030 to get it down to 4.99, which is, competitive.
Assuming the other states don't lower theirs faster.
Well, this is the thing. It's like that rate is what Indiana and South Carolina have already today. So, I mean, the opportunity cost of the decisions that get made between now and then is considerable. But again, it for Pennsylvania, it would be progress. But in his campaign that the governor said, he actually said it at the PA chamber dinner, that he wants to accelerate that phase down and bring that up to get it done by 2026, which again would be a very positive change, and that there are votes that have been recorded that lawmakers support that. So, I wish that the governor had included it in his budget request. He didn't. And again, with this stunt that was pulled by the House majority, we don't need to take a couple steps forward and then more steps back. We just need to move forward down the path and make progress on being more competitive. But for the moment, I think Steve, your term of paralysis is probably pretty accurate.
It's just a really sad commentary because there are so many good ideas, and I'm thinking all the legislators who come with good ideas their constituents bring to the table, and the paralysis that exists in that chamber right now, that nothing literally is able to come to the forefront to get done. And if you think about our democratic system of government, it is the role of the executive branch to lead and to build coalitions that can break that logjam. And we are that's why the executive branch was created, one of the reasons. And we are at a paralysis right now because we don't have that leadership, unfortunately. So just a sad commentary of where we are right now. I think you hit the nail on the head, David. We're just, even things the governor supported during the election were just not moving forward with those things.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Steve Bloom from Commonwealth Foundation. Governor Shapiro himself hasn't really been on the scene as much as he was earlier in the year. Is that – is my impression mistaken, or have you noticed that too?
It seems to be true, David. He's done some bill signing photo ops in his private office. He's gone to some other states. He went to New Hampshire and spoke there, but he's not doing a lot of traditional public appearances where the press may be there asking questions and so forth. And I think it's part of, as you mentioned, that paralysis of the executive branch. They're not using the bully pulpit to inspire the members of the House and Senate to get together and get some important things done for Pennsylvania. But there's also this there's been like a trend, I guess you would call it, an ongoing reversion to secrecy on the part of the Shapiro administration in general, the governor, and the way that the administration has been conducted. And if you look at it, once you start to see it, you realize that, you know, some of the things that we're hearing about in the headlines this week, like such as that there was everyone's heard about the resignation of one of Governor Shapiro's cabinet officers over a sexual harassment scenario, which is not fully played out yet. We don't know. We know the Senate's going to be doing some investigation of that. There's probably going to be more coming out eventually. But that's all been – the governor's typically not talked about it because he says it's part of litigation. It revolves around personnel, and there are non-disclosure agreements in place.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that secrecy. But that's just – that's not what I want to talk about today. That's kind of just a symptom, like the tip of the iceberg,
okay,
in terms of secrecy on the part of the Shapiro administration. They've been doing things even since the transition, even during the inauguration. They started out using non-disclosure agreements for everyone who worked on those committees for the inauguration, and then they refused to disclose the donors who paid for the party that every inauguration of every governor has. There's always a big celebration, and they don't want to put that on the taxpayers, and so they typically recruit some private individuals or companies to provide food in kind or drinks in kind, music performance, pay the bills for rent for a venue.
Right.
And it's a typical thing. And most governors in Pennsylvania have always released a list of who paid for it.
Sure.
But Governor Shapiro, no. Hmm. And that's as he's, you know, before he's even sworn in. And then we've seen it devolve quickly. Unlike the previous governor, Tom Wolf, his predecessor, Shapiro shut down the public calendar as to where he'll be and who he's meeting with every day. So now we don't know. I can't answer your question, where is he? Has he been around the state? We see these occasional photo ops, but that's about it. We don't know where he is because his calendar's not public.
Huh. Well, and it's, you know, it I mean, I guess it's easy for it's an easy talking point for a candidate to say, you know, when I am elected, that we will be the most transparent administration in history. I think I've heard that a couple of times now. And yet somehow it never really seems to go that way, that Governor Wolf, you know, upon taking office, he promised that he would be open and transparent. And I can think of any number of things, certainly the pandemic lockdown fiasco and the business closure orders and the waiver process and all that stuff. But I mean, again, that Governor Shapiro won. He won in a resounding fashion. He pulled over a lot of, you know, independent and Republican votes. And I think part of that was because, you know, he promised to be different. And so this is, you know, kind of disappointing and maybe a little bit distressing to see him and his administration operate in this manner.
Yeah, they've done some things that just seem blatantly intentional in terms of becoming more secretive than necessary. There was an online database of state employees' emails that the public could use to get access, to get help, to get their problems resolved whenever they were having an issue with the government. He took that database down. So now we can't just find the email to the people who work for the government. You have to go through a convoluted process. The access has been cut off. And then I'm sorry.
I know, I have to tell you, that one bothers me a lot, because having worked for the state government, when I worked for the agencies, our emails and phone numbers were posted on the website. So you could click on them and email and call and all of that. And the fact that it's so difficult to find them now, and I understand what they're saying, but there are ways to protect. You know, the state has a lot of cybersecurity enhancements and things. So it bothers me a lot that it's so hard to find an email address for a state employee. They are our employees.
Yeah, they're supposed to work for us, not the other way around.
And it's not just things that involve the internal operations of the government. Another thing that the governor has done recently is he negotiated in secret with one of his largest campaign contributors, a public sector union, for a 22% salary increase in their new new contract. 22% increase.
Without publishing it publicly.
Done in secret.
Yeah.
Now, he didn't have to do it in secret. He could have easily done that in the public, but he chose to do it in secret.
Wow.
And there's this, as I said, just a pattern of unnecessary secrecy, and it's disturbing. It's troubling because it's not necessary. It's done to really keep the public voice from reaching the administration.
Well, and you said about in the one instance that the state Senate was planning on holding hearings. I mean, has there been legislative pushback on this process by the administration?
Certainly, there's been comments and commentary from the legislative leaders in the Senate. It was President Pro Tem Kim Ward that recently said she's going to convene a hearing, at least a hearing. I'm not sure if there'll be several or a hearing on the issue that we talked about earlier,
right,
with respect to the harassment claim.
Well, and it's just, you know, again, it's the there's the way the world ought to be and the way the world is. So we at least let's just put our marker down to say that because government is supposed to work for us, that there should be openness and transparency, and that those are critical elements to having accountability on the part of our government leaders for the decisions that they are making, you know, supposedly on our behalf. So anyway, I hate to have to cut things short, but here we are at the end of our time. This has been an awesome session. Rebecca, where can people go to learn more about you and your organization and the things that you do?
Absolutely. They can find the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association at pmta.org or Facebook or Twitter.
Outstanding. Steve, where can people go to learn more about you and the things that you're doing?
So our general website is commonwealthfoundation.org, but also they can visit spotlightshapiro.com to hear more about these items that the governor is keeping secret unnecessarily.
Okay. All right. Good to know. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org and on the Pennsylvania Cable Network on Sunday mornings at 8:30 with PMA Perspective. So from Steve and Rebecca and me, thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. Governor Josh Shapiro took office last January, riding the crest of a landslide election victory, and brought with him a reputation as a competent administrator who, in his own words, is able to get crap done, except he used a more earthy term than crap. For a few months, he lived up to that reputation. When a tractor-trailer accident destroyed a key bridge along I-95 near Philadelphia, disrupting traffic on one of the nation's most heavily traveled routes, Shapiro swung into action and within days had a temporary structure in place and traffic once again flowing. It was a remarkable display of his ability to get crap done. His job in cutting through the regulations and bureaucracy to accomplish that feat was indeed admirable, but in the process, he demonstrated just how unnecessary many of those rules and regulations are and how they are actually a costly and time-consuming impediment to progress. Since then, however, his reputation as an effective leader has, well, turned into a pile of the previously mentioned excrement. As the last week of June dawned, it appeared as if Shapiro's first state budget was headed for clear sailing through the legislature, his having negotiated a deal with Senate Republicans to include many Democrat spending priorities in the budget, this in exchange for a nominal expenditure to give new educational options to children in the state's most underperforming school districts. But then powerful education establishment interests, which have no moral problem trapping minority children in underperforming schools, engage their legislative allies in the Democrat-controlled House in opposition to the deal. Shapiro folded like a cheap suit, broke his promises to Senate Republicans, and line-item vetoed the scholarship program. The budget was passed, but the legislation needed to enable much of the spending was not, and a stalemate ensued. In one fell swoop, Shapiro shattered his working relationship with Senate Republicans and triggered a months-long budget crisis, one that to this day remains partially unresolved. Not exactly a feather in the cap of a chief executive who claims to be able to get crap done. That, however, is not his biggest problem. It has come to light that one of his top aides, Secretary of Legislative Affairs Michael Verbe, resigned in the wake of sexual harassment allegations lodged by staff members. A taxpayer-funded monetary settlement of $295,000 was paid to the victims. The settlement included a confidentiality clause that prevents either side from discussing the allegations effectively, as one media outlet reported, creating a wall of secrecy around the matter. As Pennsylvania's Attorney General, Shapiro crusaded for the rights of victims of abuse by clergy in the Catholic Church. Those cases became signature accomplishments of his tenure as the state's top law enforcement official. However, his ham-handed handling of the allegations against Verbe have essentially wiped out the political capital gained while he was Attorney General. As female members of the General Assembly demanded more answers, Shapiro himself made the situation even worse. Responding to criticism from Senate President pro tempore Kim Ward, he testily retorted, "Consider the source." Such a demeaning reproach to the highest-ranking female lawmaker in the legislature further rankled women lawmakers and prompted Ward to announce the convening of a hearing into the governor's handling of the Verbe situation. That ensures the issue will remain in the headlines for weeks to come. Shapiro has also been unable to find his footing on the controversial Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGGIE. That's the multi-state compact that was entered into by former Governor Tom Wolf and immediately caused the shutdown of a coal-fired power plant in Indiana County, resulting in the loss of hundreds of high-paying union jobs. The issue is currently before the courts, as legislative Republicans have challenged the agreement, which is a de facto tax imposed without legislative approval. Shapiro has attempted to walk a tightrope on the issue, occasionally sounding for REGGIE and occasionally sounding against it, in the process pleasing nobody. All of this threatens to undermine the governor's ultimate goal of running for president of the United States. His recent trip to New Hampshire to speak at a state Democratic Party dinner essentially confirmed his ambitions, but while dipping his toes into the water of presidential politics, he is threatened at home by a tidal wave of stumbles that have dulled the early luster of his administration. At this point, the Shapiro administration's lack of transparency and frayed relations with legislative Republicans needs to be corrected and repaired if he has any hope of restoring his faltering reputation for being a skilled leader who can get crap done. With a town hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 28 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WNTP-AM and WFIL-AM in Lafayette Hill, along with WLSH-AM in Lansford, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.